All right, we're back with the Drone Zone. This is, I'm Slider,
here
with
Jim.
And we are joined by Lily Johnson, Sean Elliott, and Tom Charpentier. They are the government outreach specialists with EAA regarding SUAS and UAS operations. And
let's start off with Sean, because so you at kind of the top of this, is this kind of what we'll call the EAA drone team?
Well, certainly our government team has a heavy level of involvement with UAS operations. I'm part of the senior leadership team, and fortunately, in addition to my full-size activity, I'm also a longtime, lifelong modeler, a lifetime member of AMA, been flying model aircraft since 1979. Started with Control Line and still fly RC with my son and our friends in our clubs to this day. A very active modeler and love UAS. And we are all, the whole team here, is involved at a multitude of levels, particularly on the regulatory side, as we work with our colleagues in the FAA to make sure that as new policy or new rules come together, that it doesn't do anything that causes any potential harm or loss of access or freedoms to manned flight. You know, safety of manned flight, access of manned flight, and no new equipage requirements is kind of top of our list as we look at UAS operations. But I'll also say this, from an EAA perspective, the whole pathway aspect of model aircraft and UAS, you know, quadcopters, et cetera, is a big part of how we bring young people into aviation today.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking earlier about how the interaction of the different constituencies of this industry that is blowing up, and we find people that have their feet in a few different of those areas, where we have the Part 61 pilots that are concerned about things in their airspace, and sometimes rightfully so. You have the Part 107 pilots that are trying to operate drones commercially as part of a business model, and you have hobbyists that are out there just trying to fly for fun.
Yep.
And then you have the manufacturers that sometimes may have some of their own agenda on how their products are going to be able to be used, and sometimes they're trying to drive the ship in as much as anything else. And trying to find where does EAA fall into some of those things, because quite obviously it's a little bit of both.
Sure, yeah. Sure. So first and foremost, EAA is very proactive about saying we believe it's important to integrate. Mm-hmm. We welcome these other types of operations, and the only thing we want to make sure is that they can operate integrated versus sterile. You know, our members fly all the whole spectrum of different types of flying aircraft, right? And in some cases, not even aircraft. Ultralight's a vehicle, Part 103, right? Mm-hmm. And their access is important to us. So as these other innovative things like UAS operations really start to evolve and you know, come to light, we need to make sure that they're integrated effectively, and they have the technology to do so, and they have the structure to do so. That being said, we're also equally concerned that some of the new FAA regulations that have been propagated over the last 6 months could, in fact, cause some pretty extreme harm to the what I'll call the legacy model aviation world, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, well, we see that coming right. In like D.C. Yeah. with a lot of them shutting
we've
down.
We've got wonderful relationships with our almost 1,000 chapters across the country and the world, and the 2,500 AMA clubs. Mm-hmm. We just launched here earlier this year a brand new program called the E-Cadet, and it's a SIG-based RC trainer. It's electric-powered, that our chapters are partnering with AMA clubs to create a build project and then a learn-to-fly project, you know, for thousands of kids across the country. And what's on the horizon for model aviation, and particularly some of the restrictions around track and ID and 400 feet, et cetera, we just don't want to see the ability of those clubs to operate the way they've operated successfully and safely for decades all of a sudden get upset in a complete way. So yeah. We're working with the UAS folks at the FAA level, at the headquarters level, like we do on manned flight. We also have been working with AMA as a partner to try to, you know, minimize the impacts of what frankly has been driven by, you know, legislation and reauthorization that was passed in the fall.
Doesn't the concept of integration kind of imply that we have, you know, all of these different constituencies within the industry that are going to have to try and mesh together? Doesn't that kind of imply that you're almost expecting that we're going to find ways of bending some things, and maybe everybody gets a little bit of a give and take on it, though?
I think what it implies is you can. There's enough airspace for everybody. You just have to have the technology and the ability to have true integration with, you know, regular operations unfettered on both sides of the equation, right? We don't want to see where there's a certain altitude or a certain corridor that no longer manned flight is allowed. And likewise, we want to make sure that those UAS operators that are utilizing those altitudes in those areas can operate safely and effectively with manned flight in the same vicinity.
Exactly.
We had a conversation last year at this show with folks at the FAA, and the quote that stuck with me so clearly was, the FAA's position is that, much like in traffic laws, if they're going to establish a stop sign, it has to apply to everybody. We can't say that people on bikes don't have to obey the stop sign.
Right.
So for that reason, the FAA says if we create a rule, it has to apply to everybody all the way down to the hobbyist.
Sure.
And that made sense, except for me teaching STEM courses in high schools and middle schools, building aircraft, model aircraft, and I'm thinking that is exactly the thing that's going to stop that kind of activity.
Agreed.
You know, and so I'm faced with this conundrum of these two things make sense, and they are exact polar opposites of each other.
It is a conundrum, and I think most importantly, there's got to be a way to protect what I termed earlier, you know, legacy operations in a traditional way at a charted field, you know, in an area of airspace that has never posed a threat or a safety risk. We need to make sure we enable those operations to continue. And with proper notification, no different than how Lance is operating right now, right? There ought to be the ability for people to, you know, operate out of their local park or their local schoolyard or their local private property in a way that, you know, is still effective and safe.
What is the current thinking from the EAA advocacy perspective on the answer to this problem, the impossible question?
Yeah.
Well, what are you proposing, Sean? Give me the answer.
I wish there was a simple one.
Right.
The challenge right now is you've got very prescriptive congressional language. And they've been directed to do some very specific things in regards to altitude limits, in regards to track and identification. And, you know, the FAA is trying to look at it in a balanced way. You know, the folks that I've talked to in the UAS line of business and work with on a regular basis, they're reasonable folks, and they're trying to find the solution, but they also have congressional language driving a mandate. So to not comply with certain aspects of that congressional language, they've got to find an outlet that's also prescribed in that reauthorization that enables them to do that. And probably one of the first things is to establish a community-based organization definition, a CBO. Because once they do that, the language does enable them and empower them as an agency to deviate from other aspects of that reauthorization language by working with industry stakeholders, including a CBO.
Okay. That sounds like a lot of process to get to.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is bureaucracy at its best.
Well, yeah. And necessary. And there is, with the exception of maybe some of the hardcore hobbyists, there is a general feel that there's a general sense of, yeah, we should do something. And that's about where the consensus ends.
Yeah, you guys seem very neutral. I read through your your mandate, I guess, necessarily, your opinions on it. You guys were rather neutral, danced around a lot of topics, except you were pretty hardline on that you do not want general aviation to have to foot any more bills or anything like ADS-B. And you did actually state that, just like general aviation did foot the bill for the ADS-B, that drone pilots should be responsible, or, you know, Part 107, they should be responsible for footing the bill for any new technological necessities.
Only if that's required to operate in the NAS safely and effectively.
Well, that goes into the enforcement topic, but that's for the next segment.
Right. If they don't need ADS-B to be able to see and avoid, if there are, and I'm told there are other technologies, camera technologies, etc.
Well, NASA has a few actually out on display for their traffic management systems.
So, you know, we'd be fully embracing of that. That particular comment was around the ability for that community to integrate and operate in conjunction with the existing operations, including 103, including Piper Cubs with an electrical system. You know, all of those things we have to integrate.
Mm-hmm. All right, we are going to have another segment to chat more with the government advocacy team here at EAA. And we'll be back with more. This is the Drone Zone on EAA Radio.